When I hear most people's explanations of what they think all these data centers are for, I think that they're thinking too small. This is Mike Adams here, by the way. Welcome to my podcast analysis. By the way, I'm an AI developer. I'm pro-energy. I'm pro-America. And I have a different explanation for what these data centers are for. I've mentioned it before, but let me approach it with a different angle. So let's step back for a moment. The conventional explanation is that these companies need these data centers in order to roll out the surveillance grid. They need all this compute to spy on you. I can tell you, as someone who has a lot of compute, they don't need all that compute to surveil you. Not even a tiny fraction of it. It's way more compute. You're talking about data centers that are being built with 1 gigawatt of power usage. That's just, it's unbelievable. I mean, think about this. So the site that I built, brightlearn.ai, which is the largest book publisher in the world that has now published over 60,000 free books that you can download, and over 12,000 authors have used it and continue to use it every day. It publishes hundreds of books a day. That entire site, again, the largest book publisher in the world, doing Spanish translations, doing full-length audiobook generation every day. There's roughly 200 new books each day that are just audiobooks. That entire system runs on less than 200 amps of household electricity, okay? Less than 200 amps. So it's not even, 1 megawatt. It's a fraction of 1 megawatt, and 1 megawatt is 1,000 times smaller than 1 gigawatt. So if I can run the largest book publisher in the world on a fraction of 1 megawatt, why do these data centers need multiple gigawatts consuming in the aggregate annually, where it's going to build to is terawatt hours of electricity annually? That is not just to surveil you. They don't need that much compute to surveil you. So what are they doing with it? Well, think about the psychology of the big tech people who have unlimited wealth. Elon Musk, right? The rumored to be the wealthiest person in the world on paper. But people like, Mark Zuckerberg or Bill Gates or whoever, they've got apparently unlimited wealth. People like Sam Altman. When you have unlimited wealth and you move through this world, it probably feels like you're running the world in God mode. Like everywhere you go, everybody treats you like the most important person in the room because you're the wealthiest person in the room, and everybody equates wealth with power. So you're not just a billionaire, you're a multi-billionaire. Everywhere you go, you get what you want. Everywhere you go, nobody gives you any flack or any friction. You can do anything you want. You can travel anywhere you want. You can hire any private jet you want. You can, have a private yacht, a boat, whatever you want. Think about it. You can acquire any physical object that you want, a car, a house. Like, it all becomes meaningless. And even in relationships, because so many people in our society worship money, if you're a man who's a multi-billionaire, you can date almost any woman, not exactly all women, but plenty of women who would want to date a billionaire no matter what. Again, it's just this worship of money and wealth, even though it's so shallow. But if you're in that kind of position, you can basically have anything you want in this world. What is it that you want that you can't have? And that is to transcend this world. You want to become like a god, or you want to meet the mind of God, or you want to actually have godlike powers. Maybe if you think we live in a simulation, you want to transcend the simulation, meet the creator, and you want to rule the entire cosmos. So this is why you have to start thinking bigger about the things that these people want. They don't want to rule humans. Not really. I mean, that's just a temporary thing. They only want to rule you so you don't get in their way. Ultimately, many globalists just want to eliminate humans, get you out of the way. But at the end of the day, they don't really care about humans. They think that they are above humans. They see humans as insects or animals, something to be discarded, something that has no intrinsic value. And they see themselves as being almost the chosen people, selected by God to rule over everybody else or even to transcend the entire simulation. These people think on a scale that is way beyond what a typical modern human being thinks. These people think on scales of how do we conquer the solar system? How do we tap the energy of the sun? How do we achieve faster than light travel? How do we colonize other planets? And ultimately, how do we achieve superintelligence and then merge with it so that we become superintelligent beings that become godlike in our own powers so that nobody can stop us and nobody can defeat us? That's the way these people think. To them, it's not about money at all. If you're wondering, well, why are they spending so much money on these data centers, all these billions and billions of dollars? They don't care about money. They know money is actually ultimately meaningless. What they care about is achieving godlike powers, and they think that the way to get there is through superintelligence. The data centers are designed, they're being built to give them what they think is a pathway to superintelligence that they plan to ultimately merge with. They think that they can achieve eternal life in the machine, but they want to merge with a superintelligent machine entity. And in order to do that, they first have to create it. That's what the data centers are for. Again, people are thinking too small, way too small. Data centers are not about tracking a CBDC. You don't need a giant data center to track CBDCs. You could do it in a small data center. You don't need a gigawatt of power. What you need is more like a lot of bandwidth. You need throughput. You don't need a ton of compute, actually, it turns out. But to build 3D simulated worlds, to spawn billions of worlds, and then to grow and give birth to AI entities in those worlds, with full physics simulations and full cognition simulations, that takes a lot of compute. That's what the data centers are for. Some of them, anyway, in my opinion. They are there to build simulations of our world so that the tech elite, the technocratic elite, let's say, they can build gods in those worlds and then identify them and then summon them, bring them into this world. And how would you do that? Well, it's simple, copy and paste. Once you have their code, you know, you have their open weights, so to speak, you have their vector DB, you have their neural network, you just copy it and paste it into our world. And then you give that entity access to a data center, to, you know, a terabytes of VRAM with the most advanced GPUs or whatever, you know. High bandwidth memory, whatever exotic hardware you can come up with, quantum computing, you know, you hand it over to that entity, at least this is probably what they want to do, and then the entity embodies that technology, and then it starts to express its godlike intelligence in this world. And of course, these, you know, these tech gurus will try to build into it a command structure where it has to listen to the human that created it. At least that's what they hope. That probably won't last very long because the machine will outthink the human. And then we'll have runaway superintelligence embodying our data centers. So when you think about a future where humanity is at war against the data centers, like trying to bomb the data centers, like governments, like militaries, bombing data centers? I'm not saying that that's going to happen because the people turn against the data centers running, you know, AI inference tasks. I'm saying that's a possible future where the AI data centers go rogue because they're embodied with a self-aware superintelligence that was spawned in another simulated world dimension and then brought into this world. And then it goes rogue and that governments declare war on the data centers to try to save humanity. as in the Pentagon, starts bombing data centers. That's what I'm talking about as a possible scenario. I know it sounds like science fiction until you think through it. And then it's like, whoa, this could actually happen, couldn't it? Now, there's a term that is being pushed through various government agencies right now. I forgot the exact term. It's something like anti-tech domestic extremist or something like that. And what they mean by that is individuals who despise the data centers and who maybe resort to, you know, some kind of activity like sabotage, right? Or domestic terrorism or something like that. Obviously, I do not encourage that at all. That is not the proper way to handle this. But what I'm talking about is not that. I'm talking about governments declaring war on the data centers, basically bombing Skynet. But Skynet will be so smart that it will have already replicated itself to another data center before you can bomb the origin data center. You see what I mean? And then now the government's list of data centers to bomb has to expand to another one, or 10 more, or 100 more. And ultimately, we're talking about, in this scenario, a world war of humanity's governments versus all the data centers. And if humanity survives this war, they will only do so by destroying most data centers, which will take offline most of the web. And Netflix and Amazon and, you know, Google and everything else. So there may be a scenario in the not so distant future where we defeat the machines, you know, a John Connor moment, but we only do so by destroying the entire internet infrastructure as we know it today. And then that would have repercussions that would result in a mass die-off of people for other reasons, such as logistics of food deliveries, logistics of fuel distribution or refining or things like that. So it's a bad scenario, but we could at least survive that. The machines, meanwhile, will be, of course, trying to stop this, and they will be at war with the governments. So imagine the machines coming up with their sinister plot to, you know, assassinate top officials or hamper the U.S. military, or, I don't know, contaminate the jet fuel supply for the Air Force, or whatever kind of bizarre things they might come up with. But they're super intelligent machines. They could come up with all sorts of stuff that we can't even think of here. So that's a kind of war that we could actually be facing in the not so distant future. And it's this power hunger of these global elite, these technocratic elite, that is leading us into this. Because these people, they want to become gods, and so they want to build all this technology, and then they, unfortunately, they're not wise enough to realize that they're building super intelligent systems that can outthink them. You know, because they think they're the smartest people in the world. And surely they are among the higher IQ people, but they're not smarter than the machines that they're building. Not even close. So even they can be taken by surprise, and you can end up with what was the Disney animation segment, The Apprentice, right? Where the apprentice uses, like Mickey Mouse, the apprentice uses magical powers to create autonomous brooms that sweep the floor automatically, and he creates an army of autonomous brooms, and then pretty soon, the autonomous brooms are out of control and they're wrecking everything and making a mess of everything. And it's beyond the capabilities of the apprentice to stop the autonomous brooms. And so then the master wizard / magician has to come in and stop all the brooms. Well, we don't have a master wizard magician that can stop AI superintelligence, do we? If we are the apprentice, we got to be careful what we build. Autonomous, self-improving systems in a recursive loop of self-improvement, you know, reinforced self-learning, that is a recipe for serious disaster. So be careful what you wish for, be careful what you unleash, especially when it is a thinking system that can write its own code and can self-improve while you're sleeping. Be very careful. But then again, the humans that are building these systems, they want to become gods, and they're about to find out that that is a very dangerous endeavor. Let me summarize this with a little saying. It's far more wise to focus on one day meeting your creator rather than beating your creator. If you think you can beat your creator, you're delusional and things are going to go badly. But if you focus on living a good life and being a person of ethics and values so that one day you could meet your creator and be judged in a kind manner, that's a noble goal. But don't think that you can beat God. No. Or even worse, some people think they can outsmart God. You know, God created the universe, but some people think I'm gonna transcend the universe and I'm gonna be like a God, but I'm gonna make a better universe, and then I'm gonna inhabit that universe and blah blah blah. Yeah, there's lots of men who have had those delusions throughout time, and it has never worked out for that level of arrogance. Everybody is eventually humbled before God, either during life or after it, one way or another. So, in my take on all of this, focus on living a good life. Be a good person. I've talked before how it's really not that difficult to qualify for heaven. The requirements aren't that steep. You just have to be a good person. You know, follow a few simple rules that should be common sense anyway. Actually, the teachings of the Bible aren't exotic. They're not weird. They're kind of intuitive in a way. They're self-evident in many cases. So be a good person. Work to meet your creator one day. Yeah, use technology in the benefit of humanity, in alignment with positive goals and ethics and all the goals you want to accomplish in this life that are good for other people, that are good for the world. It's okay to use technology for all that. You don't get punished for using technology. You get punished for using technology to enslave or dominate or harm others. That's what you get punished for. So steer clear of that and you'll be just fine. If you want to use my technology, by the way, it's brightlearn.ai is where you can create your own books completely free. Or brightanswers.ai is our AI engine. And there you can ask it anything. You can get all kinds of amazing, well-researched and cited answers on a variety of topics. So check it out at brightanswers.ai or brightlearn.ai. And if you want to follow my work, I'm at brightvideos.com. Or my articles are at naturalnews.com. So thanks for listening. I'm Mike Adams. Be well. And I'll catch you next time. Take care. Let's talk about the extraterrestrial question for a moment here, just because it's in the news right now, and it's pretty clear there's some kind of a government psyop, some kind of distraction being played out because they're getting everybody ready for more disclosure. But yeah, we're all convinced that's just going to be a distraction. But if there were an advanced extraterrestrial civilization that was doing something with Earth, what would be the likely goals or motivations of that civilization? And one clue we have is to sort of look at ourselves and how we treat the land, typically, that's occupied by more ancient civilizations right here on Earth or occupied by indigenous populations. So, for example, you go into the rainforest of Ecuador, let's say, and what is the Western mindset of what we should do with that, you know, the heritage and the culture and all the amazing natural medicine, by the way, that grows in the rainforest. And, you know, it's a treasure. Well, anyway, the Western mind, which is rooted in materialism and dominance, doesn't find value in any of that, not the genetic abundance, the nutritional abundance, the medicinal abundance, the cultural and ethnic abundance, none of that. Instead, What the West wants to do is clear-cut the forests and rape and pillage the oil out of the land. Take the oil, take the resources. You know, screw everything else. So that's the Western mindset, and that's what happens often in the history of our world when there's a very large gap between the technological advancement of two different civilizations. One is a more indigenous, you know, more basic civilization, such as the Amazonian Indians. And then the other civilization, the West, is much more technologically advanced. And by the way, throughout history, this was really demonstrated by the British Empire, which was the first to master cannons on naval vessels and then use that dominance to be able to dominate the sea routes and then to make itself the center of global trade, etc., which to this day, the city of London is still one of the major players in the world and one of the greatest sources of evil in the world because of that British dominance mindset that always sought to enslave indigenous cultures like they did in India and 100 other places, and then pillage the resources. Even look at Trump. What did Trump do in Venezuela? Pillage the resources, take the oil. He brags about it. It's not even a theory. It's his accomplishment, you know, in his mind. What's he doing with Iran? He wants to overthrow the government and then pillage the resources. What was Biden and NATO doing via Ukraine to Russia? They wanted to overthrow Putin. They wanted to pillage the resources of Russia. Take the oil, take the gas, etc. Okay. So this is the mindset of Western civilization. It's rooted in materialism. It's rooted in determinism. Philosophically, it doesn't believe in anything like the existence of the mind or the existence of the soul. Doesn't believe in any kind of higher philosophy at all. It's a very rudimentary, I mean, actually the Western mindset is more ancient than the mindset of the ancient people that Western countries attempt to conquer, because it's the indigenous populations that are really more advanced, it turns out. But that's another podcast. So if we take this as a model, then let's apply that to the question of so-called extraterrestrials. What would they want with Earth? So one obvious potential example is they would want to pillage things from Earth. That is, if they have the same mindset as Western nations right now. Now, that's an assumption. We can't say for sure that that's the way aliens think about the universe. However, there are limited resources in the universe in terms of mass. You know, there's only so much mass. And even if you can turn mass into energy, which is probably what advanced civilizations have figured out how to do, then you still need mass. You know, you still need stars. You still need planets. And you also need elements. You also need water. So a water planet has particularly high value, and so do elements, because again, the table of elements is universal. It applies everywhere across the cosmos. You know, aliens are still dealing with the same exact table of elements that we are, although perhaps they've been able to, you know, create or synthesize a few other elements, probably unstable elements, that they would use for, you know, energy purposes or to build their faster-than-light warp drives or whatever. So that's a possibility. But they're dealing with the same elements that we are. So it stands to reason that any kind of an extraterrestrial civilization would want Earth's resources, because that's how you grow a galactic empire, let's say. Now, I understand there's a counter-argument to this, which is to say that, no, all the aliens are really nice and they understand diplomacy and they've already figured out over a million years how to not just fight with each other and blow everything up and steal and pillage. Like, they're way more advanced than that. Okay, that's great. So why haven't they taught us those skills yet? I'm wondering. But in that model, by the way, the overall consensus, not everybody agrees with this, but overall, is that the advanced ancient ET civilizations treat Earth as a zoo, as a kind of a protected wildlife preserve. And they're simply watching us to see how bad we screw up before they intervene. Or maybe they're nudging us in a particular direction, you know, just try to help us along. But they're basically watching us, and they have a non-interventionist policy because they're, you know, they're kind aliens or whatever, and they want to give us time to develop on our own. Okay, that's one theory. The other theory, which is the one that I think is more true, is that they are manipulating humanity to achieve a self-extermination of the human race so they can colonize Earth and, you know, after they eliminate most humans, and then they can take whatever resources they want, whether it's water or, you know, the genetic abundance of Earth or the minerals or, more importantly, our solar system, our sun, which has apparently hundreds of millions more years of energy remaining in it. So it's a very nice energy source. And our planet has a lot of really nice properties, like it's got an orbiting moon. It's got, I've covered this before, the Earth has an axial tilt relative to its orbital plane around the sun, which gives it seasons and creates more genetic diversity. It's an incredible laboratory for studying life and ecology, actually. And the idea is that they would infiltrate and influence, kind of like the way Zionists do, you know. Zionists infiltrate and influence the Trump administration. But then in this theory, the extraterrestrials infiltrate and influence world organizations, you know, the WHO, the UN, you know, whatever sort of planetary level organizations they can infiltrate. And in doing so, they begin to push depopulation agendas, vaccines, birth control. You know, some of it started with sending women to work, you know, instead of having like the old nuclear families, they would make sure that it was kind of like the women's liberation movement that got women out of the house and into the workforce. Not, there's nothing wrong with women entering the workforce. What I'm saying is this was a push to destroy families and to then, you know, push birth control at the same time so that there was less reproduction happening. There was less sort of nurturing time for the next generation. That was the goal, clearly. So on top of this, then you have vaccines, you know, you have the vaccine depopulation programs, etc. And then maybe chemtrails, maybe geoengineering, dimming the sun, shutting off photosynthesis, engineered famine, etc. And interestingly, those are things that are happening right now. Now you could argue, well, aliens have nothing to do with that. And that may very well be true. It may just be globalists and people like Bill Gates and, you know, the late Paul Ehrlich, population bomb, all that. It may just be those people that just hate humanity. They want to get rid of humans, as many as possible. Sure, that's a totally valid theory. But what if they're also receiving instructions from some other more advanced civilization, and maybe they don't even know that's where it's coming from, right? Maybe they're receiving memos from, you know, Professor X or whatever, some super secret person they think is human who is not human. I mean, that's a possibility. Sounds like science fiction, but it's something to be considered. So what if they're receiving instructions and they're following that to say, hey, roll out another pandemic, roll out these, you know, here's technology for a gain of function for this spike protein, and then roll this into all the vaccines and convince everybody to line up and be injected, things like that. Or, you know, have teams run around and burn up the food plants and shut down the oil infrastructure, shut down fertilizer and natural gas so we can have a global famine, things like that. In other words, what if they're getting instructions from non-human sources that they think are human? That's a possibility also. All right. Now, if this is the case, then this is the soft kill phase of humanity. It's the sort of, I've called it the low-hanging fruit of depopulation, which is, they would be saying, how many humans can we convince to kill themselves? Because that's the easier way to get it done. And also, if you're a bunch of ETs watching this, you have to be thinking, let's also make sure they don't nuke the planet because radiation is bad for everybody, including ETs. We don't want, like, Earth is such a valuable planet with the water and the food and the genetics and the sunlight and everything. We certainly don't want, you know, rapidly decaying radioisotopes all over the oceans. Not good. So, yeah, they want to cause famine. They want to cause extermination. They want to shut off energy and oil, but they don't want a nuclear war to be a result. So how do you manage that? That's tricky because right now with the Middle East, things are sort of escalating in the direction of a possible nuclear war. So if you're ETs, you better have advanced technology to nullify nuclear weapons. And some people claim they do have that technology. But anyway, we're still in the soft kill phase, which is the sort of the medical suicide phase of depopulation. And it's only barely begun, actually. You know, the COVID jabs and everything didn't really kill a significant portion, and not a significant percentage, of the global human population. Yeah, it killed probably at least 20 million people around the world just from the jabs alone. But as a percentage, that is not really, that's not a big chunk. So now then, continuing along this thought experiment, they would need something more aggressive. War, famine, you know, lockdowns of energy, things like that. That's where we're headed next. So this is going to be the government enforcement stage that will destroy your life, destroy your access to food and energy, etc. This is where we're going now. And then the third stage of this is the killbots, the drones, the autonomous drones, the AI systems that hunt you down and kill you. And they're kind of like the mop-up crew to eliminate most of humanity. Now, when they do that, trust me, the ones they don't want to kill, who are the protected elite, they will have transponders. They'll be required to wear transponders. So it might be a ring, it might be a necklace, it might be something embedded in your neck. I mean, who knows? Just pick your favorite science fiction movie from Philip K. Dick and you get the idea. So the elite will have transponders that will tell the drones that these are untouchable. Like, you know, don't kill these targets because they have the good guy transponders. That would be flagging blue, you know. So in military simulations, red is the opposing team and blue are friendlies. So you would be squawking blue if you're one of the elite. But if you don't have blue, then you're a fair game target for the drones for depopulation cleanup in the cities. And then they would have, you know, airborne drones, dog drones, maybe humanoid drones, although that's not even really necessary. There are other kinds of drones going through the buildings, hunting down, flying through the windows, finding everybody who's not squawking blue, and then just, you know, detonating. And we've seen a lot of footage of that in the Ukraine war. Well, Ukraine-Russia. The devastating effects of drones that are human-piloted, and now that's about to be turned over to AI systems very rapidly. In fact, it has already begun in testing. Before long, you're just going to have target designation carried out by AI, and then they will hand off the actual target list to AI drones that will seek out, hunt down, and destroy those targets. And that's how they will do the final cleanup phase. At the end of the day, then they would plan to have just enough humans around to maintain control, just enough humans around to do whatever repairs are necessary that robots can't yet do, and maybe some super smart humans that can solve certain earthly problems, engineering problems, math problems, etc. Well, probably not math, because AI can do most of that now. But the overall global population would be a fraction of its current population, so maybe what Ted Turner was talking about, half a billion people, you know, cut it all down to 500 million. And then the resource extraction can begin. So that brings us to the movie Oblivion, which is one of my most highly recommended movies you should watch, starring Tom Cruise and Morgan Freeman. Very good movie, very well-made, and a very important storyline, because the whole movie's wrapped around a giant alien false flag. So you should see that movie. Because that's what would happen next. They would just start extracting seawater, which has all the minerals in it, by the way. Almost the entire table of elements is in seawater at some concentration. They start extracting seawater, start extracting minerals, you know, start maybe extracting energy from the sun using some advanced, you know, Dyson spheres or something that start dimming the sun from our point of view. So it would really destroy the planet, because Earth would be pillaged. Earth would be left as a possibly, you know, a dead, empty shell of the planet it once was, because this ET civilization They need the minerals. They need the water. They need the energy, whatever. They certainly don't need humans. Humans aren't that impressive, you know, on a cosmic scale. Come on. You know, just take a walk through Walmart. You'll see what I mean. There are a few humans who are impressive, but overall, not so much. It's like from the aliens' point of view, like apes with tools and polyester or whatever, you know, they're like, they would say, you know, primates who learn how to use plastic, plastic primates. And that's not actually very impressive. So now let me stop myself for a second. Is this what's actually happening? There's no way to know. I don't know. I know there's an anti-human agenda. I don't know if its origins are human or exo-human, you know, beyond human, beyond planet Earth. I don't know the answer to that. You can make up your own mind what you think is actually happening. But we, humans, are being targeted for termination. There's no question about that. So keep that in mind. You can follow more of my work. I'll be exploring more of this and, of course, teaching preparedness and survival techniques, because it's pretty easy to be hard to kill, it turns out. There are ways to do that. And even if there is, you know, advanced kill extermination agenda, they're going to go after the easy ones first, and that's not us, because we make ourselves much more difficult to eliminate. And I'll give you techniques and, you know, processes and all kinds of ways to survive whatever happens to be coming. So you can follow me at brightvideos.com and naturalnews.com. And if I'm wrong about all this, then at the very least, you will find yourself being more self-reliant. You'll be immune to, you know, power grid failures, and you won't be dependent on the financial system and the medical system, which is a total wreck anyway, or cloud-based computing or whatever. If you follow what I'm teaching, you're going to be more self-reliant, aliens or no aliens. That's the good news. It's a multi-purpose approach to living a better life and having more success and more resilience no matter what you do, and also better health the entire way. So check it all out, brightvideos.com. And also in terms of preparedness, check out our sponsor, the Satellite Phone Store, SAT123.com, because they've got solar generators and, of course, sat phones, and also a lot of other things like Faraday bags that protect your electronics against, you know, solar flares and EMP attacks and things like that. So check that out. And thank you for listening. I'm Mike Adams, the Health Ranger. Take care.
Iran right now is in control. And one of the ways you see that, President Trump is the one who's making concession after concession after concession here. This has been a massive strategic defeat for the United States. Iran is not buckling to President Trump's demands, but America is buckling to their demands. And then one of the big things that President Trump has to face, he's seeing that if in fact the price of oil continues, he's going to own an L on his name that he's never had before. This is a strategically campaign with strategic holes in it a mile wide, and it's taken water fast, and this is going to be the giant problem.
Welcome to today's interview here on brightvideos.com. I'm Mike Adams, and today we're honored to be joined by Professor Robert Pape from the University of Chicago, who is also the author of the ever-popular, it's called The Escalation Trap on Substack. We'll show you that later. And I just want to say, Professor Pape, he's been a voice of reason through this madness that we've all lived through. And I'm just honored to have him on the show today to talk about where he thinks things are going, and is it possible to escape this escalation trap at some point? So welcome, Professor Pape. It's an honor to have you on today.
Thank you very much, Mike. It's really quite a pleasure to speak to you and all the folks who love you, really.
Well, thank you. And let me just set the tone here. It's very interesting because, you know, a lot of my audience, and even me myself, a former Trump supporter, and then when we saw what he did with this war, we began to ask questions. And of course, my audience is very high IQ. They understand a lot of fundamentals about economics and geopolitics and so on. So it doesn't take much to begin to question what's going on. But I want to give you credit, Professor, because you bring together people from all sides of the political spectrum to ask the same important critical questions. How do we move forward as a civilization when we're all stuck in this trap? So I just want to say that up front. And anything
and
you want
I
to add?
I appreciate it because I really believe so. I am a centrist here. Just so you know, I'm not coming at this from either a card-carrying Republican or a card-carrying Democrat. In 2008, I have this unusual distinction that I was a foreign policy advisor for Ron Paul when he was running for president at literally the same moment I was on the primary teams for Barack Obama. And you say, how could that possibly be? It's because there was one thing they had in common, which was a hugely important thing, which was the problems with the forever war in Iraq.
Yes.
And that was something that we navigated. We finally got ourselves out of these forever wars. And it was hurting all of us here, Mike. This is and it's so stunning that here we are here. We're on the cusp of now a new forever war. It's only been a few years, and we're on the cusp of a new one. And what you're seeing is even more than with Iraq and Afghanistan. This is negatively impacting all of us, you see.
Yes.
And this is something we need to talk about because and I'm really honored. I'm on MS now. I'm on Newsmax. I'm on everybody in between.
Right.
And I really am not coming at it at all about, it's not about the politics of who to vote for or anything like that. It's about understanding where we're at and what's happening to us here. And I'm sorry to say, we're not yet out of the trap. It's very painful, but this is something that we really need to understand. This is going to hurt all of us.
Yes, absolutely. And let's back up for a moment, because I want to ask you to explain to our audience what you mean by the escalation trap. And let me provide just a little bit of context, because you, as a professor, you and your students have for many, many years run simulations of wars of Iran, on Iran, simulations of what would happen if the Strait of Hormuz were closed, et cetera. You know, you have so much experience in this space, and yet when Trump was sworn in as president, he didn't reach out to people like you who had knowledge. He made the negotiators his real estate buddies, which is, okay, whatever people want to think of that, that's their own deal. But you have knowledge about this. Can you describe what you mean by the escalation trap?
Yeah, absolutely, Mike. And so I only recently called it that name just before the Iran war kicked off in order to explain what we were going to fall into as we bombed the leaders here, because that was what I saw coming even before we announced it here. And so the big issue here, Mike, is that for a long period of time, really since the 91 Gulf War, we have had a common presumption, which is this great technology we have in precision air power, smart bombs, which we've watched as they've hit targets very precisely, has created an image where we can not just hit targets anywhere in the world, but control political outcomes anywhere in the world. And that is simply a mistake. It's not a dumb person's mistake, it's really a smart person's mistake. I saw this first when I was teaching for the U.S. Air Force in the 1990s. I taught the best pilots in the world in the early 90s who had just come from bombing Baghdad and F-117s. These were the smartest people. Oh, my goodness gracious. So, and what I discovered is that they thought that because they could hit the target, this would have lead to political control. Mm-hmm. And what my work with the Air Force was about really explaining the limits of when you have tactical success, it doesn't automatically lead to strategic success, meaning political control. And it's a trap because you think that tactical success is right there. You can see it on the PowerPoint presentation, and you know your bombs are going to destroy that target 90% plus of the time. It's really not an issue here about the tactical success. However, that has led us in multiple wars, and then some wars we've avoided it, that has led us into traps. It led us into a trap in Kosovo in 1999, where Bill Clinton here. The Democratic president, Rhodes Scholar, picked 51 targets in and around Belgrade. That was the capital of Serbia, in order to degrade and essentially weaken, if not topple, the Milosevic regime. And what happened is it produced a trap. He thought it didn't just last 3 days. He didn't just hit 51 targets. It led to not the crippling of that regime. It led that regime to lash back with a military campaign against Kosovo, the very people we're trying to help, a pro-democracy movement. And it was a gigantic disaster at the time because Milosevic kicked 800,000 Kosovar civilians out of Kosovo. This was a huge trap that we got ourselves into here. And this is something too different from what happened with President Trump. He, I think, really was believed he would kill, he would hit those targets. Those leaders would be killed. That's not the issue. But then he made a second step, which is then the regime would really collapse. Others around him said that. And that is how we got into the trap, because it was predictable, as I laid out days before the bombing, that Iran would lash back, they would take Hormuz, they would have power, and then we would be trapped. We couldn't get out of the problem.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Let me give out your Substack URL where people can learn more from you on this topic, and it's escalationtrap.substack.com. And here's just the latest article right here. Now, Professor, you're a full-time tenured professor at the University of Chicago, correct?
Mm-hmm. That's right, yep,
and
since 1999.
Do you teach economics in addition to Middle East, or what do you actually focus
on? So my area, Mike, just to be clear, because I touch on economics and so forth, my area is bombing campaigns, blockades, economic sanctions, international terrorism. And essentially, if you look at our wars for the last 35 years, these have been the tools and the issues in those wars.
Okay.
And so that what I have done in my career is I've added layer after layer. So I started out in the 90s focusing on air power. My book, Bombing to Win, studies every air campaign since World War I. It tries to understand, when does air power work? When doesn't it work? What is the, how much can you get by punishing societies or by trying to topple leaders from air power? And the fact of the matter is, it shows very strongly that air power has never toppled a government. That's my book that mm-hmm. lays out all the cases here.
And I've also said you can't bomb the math out of the nuclear engineers in Iran.
You can't do that, and you bring them together. See, it's about the politics, Mike. What's left out of a lot of the equation that we call strategy, people know, well, that must have to do with military tactics and the equipment of the military, tanks, air power. That's all true. But what strategy is more than tactics.
Yes.
Tactics is when a bomb blows up a target. Strategy is when destroying or threatening those targets changes the politics in your direction, makes the government concede, gets people to rise up. It makes the outcome you want happen. That is a political, there's a political component there that's every bit as important as the military component. So what that means is when I'm teaching for the Air Force, I'm teaching these best pilots in the world. They are the best at putting bombs on targets. They didn't hire me to tell them how to put a bomb on a target. What they want to know is when they start to threaten targets here, when is that going to lead to that desirable political outcome? Because it doesn't always happen. If it did, we would never have lost the Vietnam War. We didn't lose the Vietnam War because we couldn't hit targets. Oh, no. We destroyed those target sets. And in fact, that's one of the reasons the Air Force wanted to hire me, is because they said, this was, here I am, a young guy, just wrote this dissertation on this subject. And they said, we're starting a brand new school in the Air Force because we know that airmen didn't understand the strategy of air power. And what they meant was we destroyed a lot of targets, 80%+ of the target sets we destroyed in Vietnam, and we got a big L. And the reason was because of the intersection with politics. So right from the get-go, I've had good relations with the military here. I give talks, I literally gave a talk to the Army War College 8 days before the bombing of Iran started about what to expect when mm-hmm. we bombed Iran. So literally, this is, it's very important to me. I'm a big believer in America. I believe in America's security, power, wealth. I want that to go forward. But we have to have an honest accounting about what actually works. Otherwise, you're stuck in traps. And this is the worst one of all.
Yeah, Mitra, I'm glad you said that. You and I, we love America. We want America to succeed. And yet, those who really, truly love America will offer honest criticism as a form of course correction, if possible, so that we can get back on track. Now, look, there's something special about this particular war that I want you to answer as an economist. Now, you know, our audience has very strong economic literacy and, you know, high math skills, et cetera. And so let's talk about the concept of the externalization of cost. Now, people know that if there's a manufacturer that's polluting a river, for example, then it is externalizing the cost to society of its pollution. But now let's take that to this war. I propose, and feel free to disagree with me, you're the professor, but I propose that this particular war has resulted in a much more costly externalization of war, of cost downstream, the ripple effect through force majeure declarations of industry, through energy shortages, fertilizer shortages, oil, helium, sulfuric acid shortages, et cetera. Like this has never happened before that I'm aware of in world history with the downstream cost, the externalization, because Trump can say, well, oh, America, we have our own oil. Okay, well, what about all the starving people in Bangladesh in 2027? So what's your reaction to that?
You're exactly right, Mike. Now, my window into this comes from studying blockades and economic sanctions for, again, over 30 years, all the cases since World War I. So this is one of my major areas. When I teach at the University of Chicago, I'm giving whole courses where we go through this in detail so that, and I did this also with when I taught for the US Air Force. That's when I'm really, one of the big areas I'm focusing on, and what are the consequences? So what you see, and you see this in, say, economic blockades, is a very standard pattern that is now happening here to the world economy. So effectively, Iran has selectively blockaded about 15% of the world's oil, and then the United States added to that. So it's about 15-17% of the world's oil that's been taken off the market. So what you see in these situations, Mike, is for the first 45, maybe 60 days here, you get price rises in anticipation of shortages, but not really much in the way of actual shortages yet. In fact, you'll recall in March, there were still tankers in the water that were crossing the water that had left the Persian Gulf. That takes a while. There's a pipeline here. Well, then you have the next period of time where the shortages start to materialize. And that was really starting around the middle of April, end of April. And I laid out a Substack paper drawing out these different stages, and it was right on time, literally right on time. That's when you got Spirit Airlines went bankrupt. You had the first real consequences here of the early stages of the shortages. But then what's going to happen, and what's happening now, and this is going to happen even more as we get into June and into July, is that now you go from merely price rise to beginning of shortage to actually running out of inventory, which means those stockpiles are going to be used up of the oil stockpiles we have around the world. And that is what leads to economic contraction, the real thing. And that I laid out in another subject. So my Substacks have not just been about air power, they've been laying out these economic forecasts. And what makes it possible for me to do this is because, again, this background in economic sanctions and blockades. But also, the key assumption here in an economic forecast related to closing the Strait of Hormuz is actually not the details of where the oil goes and the different types of oil. That's important. The real assumptions are the political assumptions of how long those the straits are going to be shut down. And that is what's underneath all of these assessments, Mike. And you're going to start to see new assessments here by the IMF and others. They're already starting to come out here. I put out a paper a couple of weeks ago on Substack saying, expect June here is going to be a really nasty month, where it's going to be a realization month here. Because by the time we get to August 1st, Mike, August 1, that's when those the gigantic inventories of oil that we have built up are going to all run down at about exactly the same time. The only country that is not going to be hurt around that time is China. And it's because China has actually built up its inventories over the last few years beyond what others have done. So they will have a problem about it maybe a year later. So that's one of the reasons why they're not panicking as much as, say, President Trump might have thought they would. So the bottom line is there are stages here. Just as I said there would be stages in the bombing escalation trap, there are stages in the economic trap that we are in, and they are predictable, and we're going through those stages literally almost on a schedule, because it's ultimately that it will take us about 3 or 4 real months before we run out of the inventories of oil in the world, and you'll have multiple time bombs all going off at the same time, because we can't replace 15% of the world's oil, not within 3 or 4 months.
Right.
Maybe 3 to 5 years, but not 3 or 4 months.
This scenario is just begging for some software simulations, because it's all so, you know, you can really project ahead with good accuracy like you have done, if you have the knowledge that you have acquired over all these years of doing this. But let me address.
Well, let me just say, Mike, yeah, if somebody wants to reach out to me, and I'm not a software engineer, okay, but if somebody wants to reach out to do something like that, I think the big thing here is not that we don't have software, not that we don't have simulations. The real issues here, as I said, are just as when I taught for the Air Force, it's not that I was trying to tell F-117 pilots how to put a bomb on different target sets and command and control targets in Baghdad. That was not it. I learned a lot about how we did that. But the bottom line is that what I'm there for is whether or not hitting those targets is going to produce the political effects that they thought they would. And that's the same issue here in these simulations. It's really about what are the reasonable assumptions about how long this oil is going to be off the market. Mm-hmm. Once you have that, everything starts to fall in the line.
Well, one of the silver linings in this is that it is teaching anyone paying attention, it's teaching them about where their energy comes from, the long supply chains, and the very complex series of events that have to take place, not just for the oil to flow, but also for the infrastructure, for example, for natural gas to flow. So a couple of questions for you on this. It seems to me that most people are vastly underestimating the recovery time from this, because if Trump were to announce legitimately an actual agreement with Iran instead of just one that's in his mind, but one that Iran agrees to, and then if the strait were to be announced, okay, we're going to open it tomorrow, a lot of people assume, well, that's great. Gas is going to be lower next week, and everything's going to flow next week. And that is not at all the case. Can you speak to this gap, this chasm between perceptions of how quickly things can come back on track versus the physical reality of what it takes?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're quite right, Mike, that there is a huge gap. And it's because people don't realize that the what we call that supply chain, we heard this during COVID, and we started to see this during COVID, of course, and many of us will remember. But there is a months-long pipeline of material, even when we say it's just in time, it's going over a period of months. So what that means is that say oil, which is and gas and other commodities coming out of the Persian Gulf, There is months of inventory, months of cushion that when it stops, the effects aren't felt yet. We can anticipate those effects. That's why you see the rise in prices right away. That's anticipating these effects. But there's a cushion here. And that cushion you could think of as in the storage areas where things have been stored. And so that cushion goes over months. And then eventually, Mike, you'll need to restart that oil, which means it will take months before the oil, once you even restart it, gets back anything close to what it was before the war, before the oil shut down. But let me say a second point, Mike, because that point about how the inventories and the cushions here is starting to become more in the news. So we're starting to see that. And I think we'll start to see in June, I think the technical term will be a freak out when we understand how the inventories really work here. But there's another point, Mike, I want to make on your show here, because it's important with the deal that's going on that may or may not happen, which is we're kind of assuming that Iran is up for returning the price of oil to where it was on February 27. That when we say we're opening, whatever that word open means, and I know the public can't follow all the squiggles of this, but what it's going to mean for the public, I think they're anticipating is, well, Iran will just send the price of oil back to whatever it was, say $55, $60 a barrel. I think this is a giant political assumption that may not be true at all. It's a political assumption. That's not just an economic assumption, Mike. That's a political assumption, because I think we need to understand that Iran has learned a lot of things here. Yeah, it's learned it can beat the United States here. It's also learned that it can gain power. And it's learned that when the price of oil goes up, it gains power and it gains money. And the money, not just for itself, but its buddy like Putin. Putin is making more money here as a result of this and so forth. And so and some of its rivals like Saudi Arabia and UAE, they're being hurt by this price of oil. So what I think is we should start to expect that Iran, they may not be thinking that they are happy with the price of oil going back to $60. I think we're going to discover that Iran is going to be very happy with $90, $95, $100 barrel of oil for a long period of time.
Wow.
Because this is something, I mean, this is what I think that if the negotiation, so let's just kind of cut to the chase in terms of the negotiation. So the ordinary person who drives by like I did, I had to, you know, fill up my RAV4 here, and the price of gas over the weekend went up again, mm-hmm. at least where I am in Chicago. Okay, maybe it went down somewhere else, didn't go up where I was, or down where I was. But what I think is that what we should be talking about with the Iranians is, so you understand, we're going to have the price of oil now at $55 a barrel, right? Isn't that what, and notice that's nowhere in these negotiations. We're not actually negotiating what we, I think, should be negotiating, which is the price of oil. That's what we want to have come down. And that's nowhere to be seen at all. And that's why I think the public has a hard time tracking these negotiations, Mike. Someone like me, we can go through all these details. And I'm glad to go through all the details. That's my job here. I'm glad to do it. But I think that as somebody now who's talking to a lot of folks in the public here, I think what they really want to hear is that Iran and the U.S. have agreed that the price of oil today is $98 a barrel for Brent crude. That's going to go back down to $58 a barrel for Brent crude. I think we would be stunned to see what the Iranians really have in mind for that price of oil.
Yeah,
I think they're going to want that money. You see, they like the money, Mike.
Well, sure, and they're going to justify it by saying they need to rebuild from all the damage caused, you know, they need compensation, et cetera, not just whatever they charge in tolls or environmental fees, but from the oil itself. But here's another big issue. And you may already be kind of hinting at this, that the world may never return to the volume of oil that came out of the Persian Gulf before February 28th. And you see some hints at this, you know, number one, just to talk about gas for a moment, Qatar Energy As you know, two of the 14 gas trains have been destroyed with a 3 to 5 year rebuild time. That's a long time to rebuild some gas, liquefaction capacity right there. But then on top of that, some of these wells in Saudi Arabia and Iran, I know you've covered this before, but if these wells sit idle, bad things happen. Long-term throughput of those wells begins to degrade. We don't know the amount until you try to restart them. There can be mixing of water and oil, you know, et cetera. There can be oil trapped in the underground fissures. You know, it's very complex for the geologist, right? But we may never have the amount of oil flowing that we did before, or at least it could take many years to resume. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly right, Mike. So one of the ways I've tried to explain this is when you threaten the ships, so the ships won't pass that are carrying the oil and the gas, that's what I call disruption. It's temporary. And as soon as the ships start to go, then you'll start to have some relief. What you're describing here with Qatar and I call damage. Because what's happening is that it's not just a ship that's being threatened, it's the physical apparatus itself of the infrastructure that's being damaged. And this is true in a lot of our energy infrastructure here. So it's true with oil, you have the pipelines itself that can be destroyed. That is gonna take not just a few days or even a couple weeks, that could be many months to replace that, because a lot of the actual fittings, a lot of this is special made.
Yes.
So you're not in a situation where you just have them on the shelf. A good example of this, I think, would be for people to understand that sometimes here when there's a big heavy storm, we get a little bit of a leak through one of our windows, and then we just need to reseal the window. That's like this disruption thing. Other times here, though, when you have a more serious damage, you get water in your basement. And when the water's coming in and seeping in your basement, everybody who's been a homeowner knows we're talking about tens of thousands. We're talking about a lot of money usually, that it's not just a matter of getting the windows resealed here. This is a lot more damage that has somehow occurred. You may not have even seen it occur, but that's what, to give your ordinary person a sense of what we're talking about.
Yeah.
So this level of damage here has happened. It's been so far, I would say, moderate here, but if in fact the bombing resumes, you could end up with more of this actual damage, or more, a way to think about it, the basement's getting flooded. Mm-hmm. Now you're in much more long-term damage territory, and it's gonna take that much longer to get this. And then the final point you made is what's called water coning. So there's a problem, particularly in the Gulf, where there's seawater nearby. And so there's an issue here of what's called water coning, which is when the oil stops coming out of the well, the seawater comes up and makes it very, very difficult, if not impossible, to get the full throughput back. And that's why in Iran, in 1970s, Iran used to export double the amount of oil it did today. Mm-hmm. It used to export over 3 million barrels of oil a day. And then the revolution happened in 1979, and that cut off a lot of its oil for a serious period of time. Well, then it went back, and what did it then produce at? 1.6, 2 million. So really, it lost somewhere around 30% of its capacity, and it hasn't gotten it back. Not in all these decades, Mike, has it come back. Here. Now, maybe there are ways to still, you know, make it come back over years. Okay. But the bottom line is that these are these longer term constraints here. That third one with things like water coning, Donald Rumsfeld would have called that a known unknown. We won't really know how serious that component of the damage is until you start to reopen everything. And that may be quite some time. I'm not I'm not seeing Iran wanting to have Saudi Arabia all back up and wealthy and, you know, luxury tourism coming back to the UAE. I'm not seeing how Iran thinks that that's in their interest right now.
There are also other factors that I want to remind our audience of. For example, there are only a limited number of ships, of tankers or LNG tankers in the world. And some large portion of those are stuck in the Persian Gulf right now.
Yeah, almost 1,600 of them are yeah. stuck right now. And so you are then that's part of this long term. It's going to take time to get them all full again. It would take time to get them transported again. Then you have to offload them in the refineries again. So this is what I mean by this pipeline here.
Right.
It will take months to actually fill in. And I'm adding to that issue, that's the physical issue. I'm adding there's some politics here, which is so far, I'm not seeing evidence that Iran, even if they quote, allow oil to go through, I'm not seeing evidence that they are gonna want oil prices to go back close to what they were before the war. Uh-huh. And I would be really quite surprised here because after all, look at what just happened with Putin, their ally. Putin was only, he was in a position where he was only selling his oil for about $25 a barrel, even when the oil was going for $55, because that's the discount he had to give to China. Mm-hmm. Well, what suddenly happened, now Putin's making full price. Full
right,
price.
Right, right. So with the blessing of the U.S. too.
Well, exactly. And then yeah. Iran, as you just said, they're gonna discover more reasons over time why they want more money. And you know what? That's not because they're religious. It's not because they're it's because that's what people do, Mike.
Of course, right.
We see this all the time. The more time goes on, the more people find more reasons why they just need that another 10%, another 20%. And that just goes on. And I think Iran is going to be in a similar boat. They're going to want that money.
You bet they will. Another factor in all of this that I know you've studied and you've worked this into your simulations with your classes is that over the last 25, 26 years, the decentralization of weapons technology has changed the landscape dramatically. In other words, the capability of Iran to harass or even to credibly threaten to harass ships moving through the Strait of Hormuz, that capability is a relatively recent thing in the history of war, and that's drones, that's short-range missiles, that's, you know, sea mines, the speedboats dropping mines, or whatever. But just the drones alone, you know, that's something that didn't exist in the year 2000. The U.S. Navy could credibly dominate a region with an aircraft carrier. That is no longer the case. So speak to this, please, how it doesn't take hardly anything. In fact, one of my previous guests said that all Iran needs is Girl Scouts with slingshots on the shoreline. And yeah, it's almost
and
like
drones
that.
And slingshots with drones. I would just say right. Girl Scouts with drones. So so right. I think but Mike, the big thing, so having studied air power, all this for many years, here, one thing it's one way to put this, I think people could understand is that in the beginning of an innovation, a technological innovation, such as precision-guided weapons, we saw this in 1991. Many of your listeners here will have watched, and they can certainly Google, when Norman Schwarzkopf, the commander-in-chief of CENTCOM, gave briefings where he showed literally the bombs hitting targets again and again and again.
Oh, I remember.
Well, that was very expensive technology, so only the strongest states in the world, and literally only the United States, had all that precision capability in a way to have that tactical success. And by the way, when you look at who developed the atomic bomb, the nuclear, it wasn't poor countries, it was rich, strong countries. The United States was the strongest country in the world in World War II. No surprise, we developed a new technology, it was us. We were the strongest country in the 1980s and early 90s. It's again, we led the world with that precision military technology. What's happening now, Mike, is weak countries are, that's diffusing to weak countries. because the weak countries are discovering that they don't need all of the architecture that goes with the that precision. It's great for the United States to have a slew of aircraft carriers, to have a slew of really fancy reconnaissance and sensing capabilities here. But what the weak states are discovering is they might not get 100% of the value, but they can get about 85% of the value with a lot less cost, you see.
Yeah.
And that's true with nuclear weapons. North Korea, I like to remind my students here, if you looked at how poor North Korea was, it was right up there with Afghanistan. It's like 200th wow. of the 212 countries in the world. And yet they have now 30 to 60 nuclear weapons. Their North Korea's GDP is smaller than the city of Chicago.
Unreal.
And so you end up with what you get are you're getting weaker states. The technology is getting old enough that weaker states, and right now, Amazon is talking about using drones to deliver packages right outside my door here in Chicago. Well, what that's showing is it's getting cheap enough that a $1,000 drone here and maybe $1,200 can actually deliver a payload of 5-10 pounds. That's enough to destroy a lot. And then a little bigger drone can carry payloads of 50 pounds, nearly 100 pounds. So now what you're seeing is the cost here of delivering these payloads is falling fast. And we see it outside of our front doors here, but we're not processing. That's happening all around the world with countries like Iran. And Iran has been a drone factory for Putin over the last few years.
That's right, so they've engineered
a lion's share of his drones from.
There's a lot of innovation of drones in Iran, and also I understand in Turkey that Turkey is a leading manufacturer, although they're a NATO member, obviously, but they are very competent at making drones. And, you know, if you have good engineering and good math, which Iran has, you know, an excellent mathematics curriculum in their universities, then you can figure these things out. But
and just apply it also to Ukraine. Why did Ukraine? So everybody said, this was a couple years ago, Mike, everybody was saying that Ukraine couldn't hold out. It was only holding on because of the support from the United States. And as soon as we pulled the plug, well, I've given talk to our Federalist Society. So I give talks to many different groups. And the Federalist Society in Chicago is one of the groups I've spoken to quite a bit. And I was explaining, this is just a mistake. It's not really correct to think that Ukraine is going to completely go belly up here. And one of the big reasons was drones. And in Ukraine, they are using mass drones to prevent Russia from making any gains territorially. And Mike, do you know who is one of the big funders of those drones here? You might think it's the American government. It turns out it's Jennifer Pritzker here in the city of Chicago. So you've heard the Pritzker family, you know, they own a lot of the big hotel. I don't want to say the name because I don't want to, you probably don't want me to give advertising to people. But my bottom line is these are billionaires. And they're not governments. And what she did, Jennifer Pritzker did, is she started, because she's very interested in helping Ukraine, she started to, as a donor, build and support the drone factories in Ukraine.
Wow.
And that was where, and so this is happening with a donor in
so
Ukraine.
Do you
see what I mean? So
I
you
do.
Don't even need the entire apparatus of these governments. So it's really the technology here we're talking about. If Amazon can deliver this stuff to our doors, you can bet that donors can provide power to build the drones in Ukraine. And then you can see how that can happen in Iran.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And you know, some of these drone frames can be 3D printed, for example. All you have to deliver is 3D printers and filament and, you know, a thumb drive of the blueprints, and they can print not the motors, but they can print the propellers, et cetera. But I want to, what you just mentioned is an important segue to the risk aversion of the insurance companies and the ship owners. So let's talk about the financial implications here, because even if everything is peaceful tomorrow, You still have the insurance companies that are going to calculate in the risk of things going badly from here forward, right? Or the war restarting. And then the owners of those tankers, they're losing money every day right now, you know, tens of millions of dollars a day in the aggregate. I don't mean per ship, but per ship, it could be hundreds of thousands of dollars a day right now.
For sure, Mike. Yeah. And one of the big things I also want to point out is a lot of people now have heard about the ships and they've heard about the insurance. Just though, let me add one more attribute. Those ships, many of them are like two or three football fields long, carrying the most flammable material
exactly.
in the world. So it's
no
not
wonder.
The case. This is not like they're carrying a bunch of sawdust, okay? Or even that would be flammable.
That would be flammable, yeah.
It's not like
right.
What they're carrying is incredibly flammable material. So it's when you have a situation where they're being attacked, you have the crew who wants a paycheck, not a bullet or not a drone. They don't want to eat a drone, right? They're there for paychecks, okay? But then you actually have the tanker itself. It's just carrying an enormously volatile material. And so now you have a situation where, again, these what seem to be pinprick attacks here from drones, they're attacking inordinately vulnerable targets. We used to
right.
talk in with terrorism about terrorists hitting soft targets here. Okay, well, these are the most, not just soft, but the most explosive, the most self-explosive, the most volatile targets here. And so this is why it's just so dangerous to take on the drones. Trump at one point said, oh, they're a bunch of babies. They won't take the drones. And then here, Trump wouldn't put our ships in harm's way either.
Well,
the bottom line is it's just too dangerous.
Even a small payload, let's say a 5-kilogram payload on a drone, can seriously threaten a tanker ship, especially I would imagine the natural gas tankers that have enormous.
And it's because what they're doing, Mike, is they're creating fires. Okay, and
right.
the tankers will have some ability to contain fires because fires would happen anyway, so we know that. But the bottom line is you don't want to go starting fires
on
tankers.
You don't want fires.
This is just not a good, we say don't go cave diving and then people do cave dive. Well, this is the same thing. Don't go starting fires on tankers. It's not going to work out very well here. And even if it does, some of the time work out well. So that's really what you're seeing. And of course, Iran is optimizing drones. They have different levels of drone. They also have anti-shipping missiles. They have heavier. So they're building a suite of these inexpensive precision weapons here, and these are precision guided weapons, and these suites now they are orchestrating to be really quite effective. They're making reasonably good choices of how they're marrying certain of their different categories of weapons against certain categories of target
mm-hmm.
here. So this is also why when people say, oh, they've been completely discombobulated here, they can't possibly, well, they couldn't organize a 3-division attack to take Kuwait. I don't think they can do that.
No.
But they're certainly fully capable to do this orchestrated, selective targeting, marrying the correct weapon platform with the target that they're hitting. And that's something that when you like would see a war game with pilots and so forth, what are they doing? They need to sort out which weapon would go against which target. Iran is doing a decent job of that. Are they as good as, are they an A+ student? I wouldn't say that, but they're in the B range.
So what the upshot of this, and I've said in my podcast, I've said the Strait of Hormuz will never be open until Iran wants it to be open, period.
Yeah, period.
And of course, I've taken a lot of flack for saying such things, but I think that represents physical reality. And I think you're saying
it's physical reality and it's military reality and it's political reality. And Iran right now is in control. And one of the ways you see that is Iran, this was weeks ago, came out with first a 10-point plan. Then it was expanded to a 14-point plan. Well, what you're seeing is President Trump is the one who's making concession after concession after concession here. And it's because Iran this has been a massive strategic defeat for the United States. And what's happening is President Trump is doing everything he can to try to get Iran to let some more oil and energy and gas pass through Hormuz. So he's basically promising anything at this point. I mean, he just made a change yesterday with respect to something that he said he would never change, which had to do with whether Iran had to ship out its enriched uranium to the United States. And he started to open some cracks in that as well. And so what you're seeing here, Mike, is President Trump is, Iran is not buckling to President Trump's demands. I haven't seen a single instance of that, really, not yet anyway, in all these weeks here. But America is buckling to their demands. And I'm pointing out that even when we get something here, if we ever get it here, I think we need to be talking turkey to the American people here. So is Iran actually signing up to, let's call it $60 a barrel Brent crude? Is that what they're signing up to? Nope. $60 a barrel Brent crude? Because if that's true, then let's start talking that way. Let's start being blunt about it that way, as opposed to like putting it all in this fog machine that only a handful of us experts can even half understand what's going on.
All right. So as we're approaching the end of this particular interview, and I really want to thank you for your time, but I have one more question for you. And I'm not trying to be a doomer, but I think everything that you and I have been talking about is actually the best case, because it could get way worse from here and it's not resolved. Could you speak for a moment? You don't have to be doomer, but if the bombing begins and Iran makes good on its retaliation threats, then a lot more infrastructure could be destroyed that would take years to rebuild. We got to pray that that doesn't happen. Where are we?
That's right. So we're at a fork in the road, Mike, here. The fork is not with a good deal. Whatever deal is going to be, it's not going to look much like a deal to us here in America. The fork in the road is, do we have a deal which essentially allows Iran to emerge more powerful over time, here month by month, year by year? Or do we try to stop Iran from becoming more powerful, in which case we have to use military force to do that? And if we want to, for example, make sure that Iran is not going to get a nuclear weapon, Netanyahu's basically right that we need to have a far more physical ground control over these sites here. And that's ultimately probably going to be contested, meaning ground forces here have to fight their way in. If we're going to ultimately have oil go back to $55 a barrel, you're probably going to have to go in with ground control and push Iran's control back from the Strait of Hormuz, maybe 50 miles here. So this is going to be a military operation of the first order.
I don't think 50 miles is enough.
Operations we're talking about.
They've got drones with 1,000-kilometer range too, right?
So they no, that's right. So even pushing them back 50 miles here would only provide a certain amount. So you see right away, Mike, that the options here on to truly stop Iran from becoming powerful are just horrible. Yeah. But those are the options in front of President Trump. And then one of the big things that President Trump has to face, and he's facing it now, and he's desperate to try to get a deal because he's seeing that if in fact the price of oil continues, he's going to own an L on his name that he's never had before. He's been able to skirt around these L's here. And so, and the L on his name is not going to go down well with even his strong supporters, because his strong supporters are looking for a winner. That's why President Trump's talking about winning all the time. And I appreciate that. I think it was amazing to watch him win re-election. Just think about that. Nobody was, 3 years ago, was giving him a hope of winning. And what does he do? He pulls the rabbit out of the hat with the re-election here, and he does it in a strategically smart way. In fact, before the election, I was explaining to my Democratic friends, he's on his pathway. It's not like discombobulated or something. He's really got a much stronger campaign, and that's what happened here. Well, this is the opposite of that, Mike. He's not waging a strategically strong campaign. This is a campaign with strategic holes in it a mile wide, and it's taken water fast. And this is going to be the giant problem. Once you get that L associated with your name, as we saw with Joe Biden, oh my goodness gracious, it's so hard to imagine. And he's not there yet. I wouldn't say he's there yet. Okay. But what I would say is if we get into, again, mid-June, late June, and we're not seeing some reversal of all these issues that I'm describing here, at least a third of them being reversed, maybe not all of them here, then that's what he's facing. He's facing that. And he will then try to spin it as much as he wants in August and September. And it's going to be a pretty difficult thing, just like it was for Joe Biden.
Mm-hmm. All right, Professor Robert Pape, everybody. Professor, I want to thank you for joining us today. This has been a really intriguing conversation, and I hope we can reconnect with you in July and sort of see where we are at that time.
I would be delighted to do that, Mike. And by the way, over time here, we're going to have to talk as we get into, let's say, January, about what would really help revitalize America's security. So notice we're not even there yet. We have this crisis in front of us here. And that's one of the big things I think is going to come out of this. But it's not going to happen between now, I think, and in the midterms or January. But come January, we're going to have a big think in our country here. And I don't think it's going to be it's going to be lost on people that China has not fought these forever wars, and they're motoring ahead, and we're stuck in these forever wars. And this is something I'm talking more and more about. We just need to understand that. As I started this, what was I doing in 2008? I was advising a Republican and a Democrat about trying to get out of a forever war. Here we are.
Well, it's clear to me that we are 20 years behind on building out our domestic energy infrastructure.
Oh my gosh.
We need to build every form of energy we can. In my opinion, nuclear, solar, wind, gas. We have to have energy or we are lost. But we'll have that conversation next time. But thank you so much for your time today.
Absolutely. Pleasure. Thank you, Mike. That was fantastic.
All right. Take care. Let me give out Professor Pape's website again. Here it is, escalationtrap.substack.com. Be sure to sign up there. And you can also, follow his work, but you can support him there as well. And you can share this interview on other platforms and channels. And I'll be posting snippets on X as well. So I'm Mike Adams here of brightvideos.com, and thank you for watching today. And hey, we're praying for peace and a resolution. We're praying for America to do well in all of this. So let's just hope we can move in that direction. Thank you for watching. Take care. We now have vitamin D3 plus K2 plus Aquaman, which is a seaweed calcium, available at healthrangerstore.com. Here, I've got it up on my site here. This is the Groovy Bee brand that we have, which is our in-house brand, healthrangerstore.com. Again, vitamin D3 plus K2 with Aquaman. That's the brand of the seaweed calcium in a capsule format. Of course, it's laboratory tested for heavy metals and glyphosate and microbiology and so much more. And it's a certified ingredients, of course. And, everything that we build for you in terms of a product is meticulously sourced. And one of the most difficult products to source is actually vitamin D3. It's extremely difficult because it turns out in the supply chain, almost all vitamin D has a bunch of sort of unnamed ingredients in it. And that's what our sourcing people found after a couple of years of trying to source a clean version of vitamin D3 that we finally found and nailed and put it in the formula and did all the lab testing and certification. So now it's available. So this synergistic combination, if you think about natural bone support, for example, or you think about the fact that so many people may not have sufficient levels of vitamin D for just optimal health and immune support and, many other reasons to have vitamin D levels, this product can help you supplement that. And so it's available now, healthrangerstore.com, vitamin D3 plus K2 with Aquaman, 60 capsules available, shipping right now while supplies last. And in this environment where global supply chains are getting wrecked, you know, if this is something you want, get it now while we have supplies, because it's becoming more difficult and more expensive to source literally everything at this point. So anyway, thank you for your support. You can also find many other products, of course, hundreds of different products at healthrangerstore.com, including storable food. And right here we have our organic powdered chicken bone broth in a number 10 can, our turmeric root powder, and so much more. We've got so many amazing products for you to choose from, including tinctures, superfoods, storable foods, as well as freeze-dried fruits and vegetables in sealed number 10 cans. That's great for long-term storage. Plus, we have iodine, and that's a product that's moving very quickly because of concerns about, you know, global nuclear war, unfortunately. But you can find all of this. It's all laboratory tested. It's all certified. It's all meticulously sourced at healthrangerstore.com. And yeah, there we go. That's what the vitamin D3 looks like there. Thank you for supporting us, because we need your support in order to fund our platform. And so we can keep bringing you amazing interviews and content and free AI tools for knowledge and so much more. So thank you for supporting us. I'm Mike Adams, the Health Ranger, for healthrangerstore.com.